We are starting a deep dive today into a brand new series,
Yes, we are.
and we are going right into it. It is called The Devotion Economy,
Right.
subtitled Fandom Identity and the Machinery of Attachment.
It's a heavy title, but it's incredibly accurate.
It really is. And over the course of this whole series, we are going to be taking a very, very close look at how the machinery of devotion has basically been industrialized.
Yeah.
We're going to examine what that industrialization actually costs, you know, and what it reveals about the complex relationship between people, the things that they love, and the massive industries that have figured out exactly how to profit from both of those things.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Because it is a massive, massive industry.
Right. And our focus today is entirely on the very first essay in this series.
Yeah, which sets the foundation for the whole thing, really.
It does. The essay is titled The Music Never Lies: K-Pop, Manufactured Cool, and the Accidental Blueprint. And it was written by Darling Missy.
Such a fascinating piece of writing.
Oh, it's brilliant. And the mission for this deep dive today is to guide you, the listener, through a core thesis that is honestly going to change how you look at the entertainment you consume.
It really will. You can't unsee it once you understand the mechanics.
Totally. The argument here is that K-pop has essentially reverse engineered human attachment. Like, they've turned it into a revenue model.
Right.
They haven't just created fans, they've created a mode of engagement that functions much more like an identity than, you know, traditional fandom.
Yeah, it's not just about liking a song anymore.
Exactly. Okay, let's unpack this because I want you to think about the last time you felt a really deep connection to a musician.
Right.
You liked their sound. Maybe you bought a ticket to a show.
Maybe bought a t-shirt at the merch stand.
Exactly. Now, I want you to imagine that organic feeling of connection being studied in a laboratory, like broken down into its psychological components and manufactured at a global
It
scale.
sounds a bit dystopian when you put it like that.
It does. But to understand the mechanics of how that manufacturing actually happens, we have to establish an analytical lens.
Right, which Nisi does brilliantly in the essay.
So we're going to use a framework from a 2001 PBS Frontline documentary
Yeah, called The Merchants of Cool.
directed by Douglas Rushkoff.
Right. And the core premise of that documentary, which we really need to keep in mind today, is that corporate machinery is just constantly studying authentic youth culture.
Constantly.
It identifies what young people are doing organically, it co-opts it, manufactures this like pristine, frictionless version of it, and then sells right back to them.
Fills it back at a premium.
Exactly. And that is the through line for our entire conversation today.
Right.
We are taking that Merchants of Cool framework and applying it directly to the K-pop industry.
Which establishes a rather uncomfortable reality
Extremely uncomfortable.
that K-pop is not actually a music industry at all.
No.
It is a relationship industry.
That's the crux of it right there.
Okay, I have to push back here for a second.
Sure, go for it.
Because hasn't the music industry literally always tried to figure out what's cool and sell it?
Well, yeah.
I mean, what makes K-pop's version of this any different from, say, American pop music in the
Right, the
90s?
boy bands and all
Yeah.
that.
The major labels back then were absolutely doing the exact same thing with boy bands and girl groups. They were focus grouping their clothes, their
And
sounds.
personality slip.
Exactly, the bad boy, the cute one, the shy one. How is this any different?
It's a fair question, but the difference is entirely about the sequence of creation. And honestly, the scale of the psychological manipulation.
Okay, break that down for me.
Let's look at the difference between artistry that succeeds because it's highly specific versus the pure Merchants of Cool method.
Right.
Genuine art, it finds an audience because an artist has a specific experience.
A real lived experience.
Exactly, a specific friction in their life, and they express it. And the audience resonates with that truth.
They hear it and say, "Oh, I feel that too."
Right. But the Merchants of Cool method works in reverse.
Okay.
It does not start with an artist who has something to say.
Wow, right.
It starts with identifying a market trend that is currently generating heat.
Just looking at the data.
Purely.
Okay.
And then the machine completely empties that trend of its original cultural context. It removes the friction that created it in the first place, and it sells a shiny kind of simulacrum back to a target demographic.
So American pop in the 90s definitely played with this formula.
Oh, absolutely, they did. But they didn't industrialize the psychological bond itself.
Right.
At the end of the day, in the 90s, they were still primarily selling the song.
selling the CD.
Exactly.
Right. And, you know, it wasn't always this rigid, heavily guarded machine in South Korea either.
No, not at all.
Which the essay points out. When Korean music first started reaching the rest of the world, it was actually very organic.
Super organic.
It reached the West through these incredibly varied, completely uncoordinated pathways.
Just completely random sometimes.
Yeah. Like, you might have stumbled across an artist because they were featured in the back of an imported anime magazine.
Right.
Or maybe you heard a track while watching the movie Speed Racer.
Oh, my gosh.
Or yeah. Maybe you watched the Korean drama Dream High. You'd be watching it with subtitles on some laggy, ad-filled streaming site.
Waiting for it to buffer. Yeah.
Exactly. Or, you know, the YouTube algorithm just happened to feed you a music video at 2:20 a.m.
Right, because those were natural pathways.
Yeah.
Listeners arrived through whatever door just happened to be open to them at the time.
They had to actually search for it.
Exactly. They discovered the music organically, which means they formed a connection to it based on their own curiosity and their own taste.
Right. It wasn't forced on them.
No. And this was long before K-pop became the rigid mainstream category that is today.
So different now.
And the reason this shift, you know, from organic discovery to manufactured delivery, the reason it matters to you, the listener, is because it changes the fundamental nature of music consumption. When authenticity itself is processed into a product, the music stops being the main event.
Wow.
The song becomes completely secondary to the psychological bond you are forming with the artist.
It's like the song is just the Trojan horse to get you into the relationship.
That is exactly what it is.
And once you're in the relationship, the industry can monetize your devotion in ways that far exceed the price of a compact disc or a concert ticket.
Oh, way beyond a $15 CD.
Right. So if we accept that this modern K-pop machine is the absolute ultimate execution of Rushkoff's Merchants of Cool Loop, we have to ask a question.
Where did it come from?
Exactly. Where did the physical architecture of this machine actually come from?
And the answer is pretty surprising.
It really is.
Yeah.
Because the answer isn't Seoul in the 1990s.
No.
It is Detroit in 1959.
Yeah. We are talking about Berry Gordy's Motown Records.
Which is just wild to think about.
But it makes perfect sense when you look at the history. Berry Gordy was famously inspired by the Ford assembly line.
Right, because he had actually worked there himself.
Exactly. He worked at the auto plant, and he looked at how raw steel was brought into a factory, passed along a highly structured, compartmentalized line, and driven out the other side as a completed automobile.
Right.
He looked at that and thought, well, why can't we do that with hit records?
Why can't I build a hit-making factory?
So he did. He built a factory. He established in-house writers, rigorous quality control systems, and incredibly strict training for the artists.
Like beyond just singing.
Way beyond singing. They weren't just taught how to hit the right notes. They were subjected to etiquette classes.
Wow.
They were trained in how to give interviews, how to manage their posture.
Literally how to stand.
Yeah. And how to perform a highly sanitized version of Charm that wouldn't offend middle America.
It was a total 360-degree grooming process.
Completely.
And, you know, looking at the supplementary context on music history that we have, this Motown system strongly echoes the Brill Building formula from New York.
Oh, absolutely.
The Brill Building was essentially a vertical integration of pop music.
Just a hit factory.
Literally a factory. You had writers in cubicles on one floor writing melodies.
Right.
Passing them to lyricists on another floor, who passed them to arrangers, who passed them to a house band, who finally recorded it with a vocalist.
It was assembly line.
It was. A factory producing ready-made hit singles by passing them through a specialized, compartmentalized workforce.
And the genius of it, or the cold efficiency of it, maybe, is that it removed the unpredictable variable of the quote-unquote tortured artist from the equation.
You don't have to wait for inspiration to strike if you have 50 guys in cubicles writing hooks.
Exactly. But the American music industry eventually abandoned this massive artist trading machine.
Right, they didn't keep it.
No, they abandoned it simply because it became far too expensive to maintain.
The overhead.
Yeah. Paying for years of artist development, choreography, vocal coaches, media training, and housing before an artist ever released a single record or generated a single dollar of revenue.
That is a huge risk.
It was a massive financial risk because if the artist flopped, the label lost millions in sunk costs.
So they just stopped doing it.
Right. The U.S. pivoted to signing artists who had already built their own followings.
Basically outsourcing the development costs back to the artists themselves.
Exactly. You get famous on your own, and then we'll sign you.
But South Korea didn't abandon the assembly line model.
No, they doubled down.
They looked at that Motown blueprint, they kept it, they scaled it up massively, and then they globalized it.
And this isn't just a theory. Lee Soo-min, the founder of SM Entertainment,
which is basically one of the foundational pillars of modern K-pop.
Right. He has explicitly gone on the record citing Motown as his direct inspiration.
He wasn't hiding it at all.
Not at all. He looked at Motown's picture cards.
Oh, this is fascinating.
Yeah, so Motown used to distribute these little collectible photos of artists like the Miracles and the Supremes.
Just to build a sense of personal attachment between the fan and the performer.
Exactly. And Lee Soo-min took that exact concept, and it evolved directly into today's highly lucrative K-pop photo card culture.
Which is a billion-dollar industry on its own.
Which we are going to dive into deeply a bit later.
Right. But to fully understand the cost of this machine, we really have to apply the Merchants of Cool lens to K-pop's massive debt to Black American musical tradition.
Because that debt is foundational.
It is. And this isn't a secret in the industry either. The CEO of HYBE, the massive entertainment conglomerate behind BTS, has openly stated on the record that Black music is the base.
Yeah, he said that explicitly.
If you look at the fundamental architecture of the music, the hip-hop aesthetics, the R&B vocal runs, the syncopation of the choreography, it all traces a direct, undeniable line back to Black American lineage.
Absolutely.
But this is where the Merchants of Cool Loop does its damage and where the mechanism of extraction becomes really clear in the essay.
Right.
The industry appropriates that base entirely. We see K-pop idols wearing grills. We see them using African-American vernacular English as a performance of coolness.
It's treated like a costume.
Exactly. There are multiple documented instances across the industry of the N-word being used in songs and on variety shows by idols who have absolutely no connection to the cultural weight of that word.
None at all.
They are just wearing the aesthetics of Black culture as a costume.
It is aesthetic extraction without the cultural burden.
Wow, yeah.
Because, you know, genres exist for a reason.
All right.
They tell you where something comes from, who made it, what specific pain or joy or community it served.
They are rooted in soil.
Beautifully put. But the K-pop machine identifies the cool factor of Black music and surgically empties it of its historical, political, and cultural identity.
Just scoops it right out.
And then manufactures it into a generalized global product.
It really is the ultimate distillation of Rushkoff's theory.
Identifying authenticity, processing it through an assembly line, and returning a shiny, context-free simulacrum that can be sold to anyone, anywhere, without offending them.
So we've seen how the machine borrows its sound, its aesthetic, and its entire physical assembly line structure from these American origins.
Right.
Now, let's look at how this industry applies that exact same Merchants of Cool Loop to physically cross borders and enter entirely new countries.
The expansion phase.
Right. How do they actually deploy this manufactured product into a foreign market?
And there's a perfect case study here with the early 2000s expansion of SM Entertainment.
Using a solo artist named Boe.
Yes. The deployment of Boe into the Japanese market is an absolute masterclass in deliberate, aggressive market integration.
It's wild to look back at.
It really is.
Yeah.
If we look at the data surrounding her debut, we can see exactly how SM Entertainment approached this.
Mm-hmm.
When Boa was just 14 years old.
14.
14 years old. SM partnered with the massive Japanese label AVEX.
Okay.
They invested $3 million into her career right out of the gate.
I need to pause on that number.
It's huge.
$3 million invested in a 14-year-old.
Yeah.
That is an astonishing level of institutional belief in the system. They were essentially treating a middle schooler like a tech startup receiving a Series A funding round.
That is exactly how they viewed it.
Wow.
It was venture capital applied to human capital.
Right.
But the reason it worked so massively in Japan was because the integration was genuine.
Okay, so it wasn't just checking boxes.
No. Boe didn't just parachute in, sing a few phonetically translated songs, do a press tour, and fly back to Seoul.
Which is what a lot of artists do.
Right. Instead, they had her drop out of school, and they physically moved her to Japan.
Wow.
She learned the language fluently. She lived in the country. She participated in the daily cultural life of the Japanese entertainment ecosystem.
She actually became part of it.
She became an actual cultural bridge between South Korea and Japan.
Yeah.
And this was during a time of intense political pressure and historical friction between the two nations.
That is no small feat for a teenager.
Not at all. She did the heavy lifting to become part of their world, and because of that genuine friction, the market accepted her.
And she was huge.
Massive. She hit number one on the Oricon charts, which is the Japanese equivalent of the Billboard charts.
Incredible.
It was a historic, monumental success.
But then the deployment strategy completely flipped.
It did.
The attempt to replicate that massive success in the American market, this was in 2008, it was a spectacular failure.
It just didn't work.
Boé pushed into the U.S. with an English track called Eat You Up.
Right.
And instead of that genuine cultural integration we saw in Japan, the label relied entirely on a manufactured checklist.
They thought they could just buy their way in.
Exactly. Yeah. They didn't have her move to America and become part of the local scene. Instead, they targeted the Billboard dance charts.
Right.
They hired Beyoncé's producers.
Of course.
They booked specific, recognizable American venues. They basically checked every single box of what American cool was supposed to look and sound like on paper.
They assumed the Merchants of Cool mechanism could force a crossover purely by assembling the right prestige components.
Just snap the Lego pieces together?
Exactly. They bought the right producers, the right choreographers, the right marketing channels.
But they did it without any cultural home.
Yes. They stripped away the friction of living in the culture and replaced it with a perfectly executed, sterile mimicry of American pop.
It's like trying to transplant a fully grown tree without bringing any of the soil it grew in.
Oh, that's a great way to put it.
You know, you can't just dig up a massive tree, wash all the dirt off the roots, prop it up in a brand new yard, and expect it to thrive just because the new yard looks nice.
Right.
The roots need the microscopic ecosystem of the original soil.
The environment.
Yeah, the shared language, the local inside jokes, the specific regional suffering. They need all of that to actually absorb nutrients.
Without that soil, the tree is just going to slowly die, no matter how much water you pour on it.
Exactly.
That visual perfectly explains the mechanical failure of the Eat You Up campaign.
It just couldn't take root.
And the major takeaway from this era of the industry is that while Korean music traveled organically to the West in the early 2000s,
finding those curious kids watching anime or digging through early YouTube?
Right. The corporate machine could not artificially force a mainstream crossover simply by checking off a list of marketing touchpoints.
The music can travel organically.
But you cannot manufacture the soul of an organic journey.
Man. And this realization leads to the biggest pivot in the history of the industry.
It changed everything.
Because forcing traditional musical crossover failed, the industry had to rethink its entire business model.
They had to find a new product.
Exactly. They realized that if they couldn't just sell the music on its own merits to a Western audience, they would have to find something else to sell.
So they decided to scale and monetize the parasocial bond itself.
Right there. The product was no longer the music. The product became the relationship.
And this brings us into the architecture of devotion.
Okay, to understand how they built this architecture, we have to look at the group that accidentally provided the perfect blueprint.
BTS.
BTS. What is truly fascinating about BTS is that they built this parasocial model organically.
Completely organically at first.
Yeah, long before it was completely corporatized and monetized by the rest of the industry.
Right. If you look at their early days, BTS documented themselves in a way that was highly unusual and, frankly, unpolished for the heavily sanitized K-pop industry.
They weren't sitting up straight in etiquette classes on these videos.
No, not at all. They released Bangtan Bombs, which were these raw, candid, handheld video clips.
Yeah.
They did low-budget V-live streams late at night from their cramped, shared dorm rooms.
They were basically just vlogging their struggle.
They were. And in 2015, they launched Run BTS, which was a weekly variety show featuring the members just playing games, bickering with each other, failing at cooking challenges.
Normal guy stuff.
But the crucial detail here is that Run BTS had absolutely no commercial tie-in.
That is wild to think about now.
Right. It wasn't promoting an upcoming album. It wasn't a sponsored content play. It was just them existing as young guys.
And because of this constant low-stakes visibility, their fans, known as ARMY, didn't just show up to support their success once they were already famous.
Right.
ARMY experienced the entire struggle, the poverty, the rejections, and the gradual rise alongside them.
That shared history is the foundational bedrock of the devotion economy.
It's so powerful.
It transformed ARMY from a standard music fan base into a highly coordinated social movement.
They weren't just consumers buying a track.
No, they felt a deep emotional ownership over the group's success.
Like they built it together.
Exactly. They became an incredibly powerful distribution channel, organizing streaming parties, buying billboards, and translating content for free.
Because they were emotionally invested in the success of people they felt they had essentially grown up with.
But of course, the emergence of Cool Loop never stops spinning.
It never stops. Once the corporate machinery saw how powerful and lucrative that organic dorm room bond was,
they swooped right in.
They swooped in to formalize it, quantify it, and charge for it.
Right.
This is where companies like HYBC and SM Entertainment corporatized intimacy through proprietary apps like Weverse and SM's Bubble.
And this is where the machinery of attachment becomes chillingly visible.
It really does.
Let's look at the mechanics of the Weverse DM feature.
Okay.
Fans pay $4.59 a month for a subscription service that sends them direct text messages from their favorite idol.
Wow.
But the genius and the manipulation really is in the user interface.
What do they do?
The interface is meticulously designed to look exactly like KakaoTalk,
which is South Korea's primary everyday messaging app.
Exactly. So when you get a message, it doesn't look like a newsletter.
It doesn't look like an email blast.
No, it is visually identical to getting a text message from your actual friend or your mother.
Oh, that is dark.
It is crafted to bypass your logical brain and trigger the exact same dopamine response as a genuine one-on-one personal interaction.
And the psychological cost of this is staggering, because by moving fans off of open forums and onto these closed corporate platforms, the industry is actually atomizing the fan community.
Right, breaking them apart.
Think about how fandom used to work. Fans bonded with each other over a shared love of the music.
They build communities.
But now they are pushed into an individualized, paid, pseudo-intimate relationship directly with the corporation's avatar.
The communal ecosystem is replaced by isolated consumers sitting alone in their rooms, paying $5 a month for a simulation of friendship.
And that atomization and monetization extend perfectly from the digital world into the physical world.
Yes.
Through the photo card economy.
Which is just massive.
It's unbelievable. Over the last decade, physical K-pop album sales have grown tenfold.
Right.
In 2023 alone, there were over 116 million physical albums sold globally.
116 million.
But if we look at the reality of how these albums are consumed, it becomes abundantly clear that these 116 million units are not being bought for the music.
Not at all. Because the compact disc itself is completely obsolete.
Right. Most fans don't even own a CD player anymore.
So the physical album is no longer a music delivery mechanism.
What is it then?
It is nothing more than a cardboard container for collectible, randomized photo cards.
This is where the gambling mechanics come in?
Exactly. Fans buy dozens, sometimes hundreds, of copies of the exact same album just to pull the randomized photo variations of their favorite members.
They are chasing the dopamine hit of the pull, just like a slot machine.
Which leads to one of the most striking visual representations of this broken system.
Okay, here's where it gets really interesting.
The massive album dumping protests.
This is wild.
Organizers recently collected over 8,000 completely unwanted, freshly opened K-pop albums from fans.
8,000 albums?
They loaded them into trucks and literally dump them back at the headquarters of massive agencies like HYBE, JYP, and SM.
Wait, they just dumped them on the street?
Right on their doorstep. The fans had ripped the plastic off, extracted the little piece of cardboard with the idol's face on it.
The photo card.
Yep, and discarded the actual musical product.
By dumping the CDs back on the corporate doorstep, the fans were explicitly saying, "We only wanted the relationship token. Here is your musical trash back."
It perfectly illustrates how the music has been entirely decentralized from the actual product being sold.
Okay, so we've tracked this evolution from organic dorm room live streams to a multi-billion dollar photo card and text message economy.
Quite a journey.
It really is. So we have to ask, what happens when this Merchants of Cool Loop is utterly perfected and deployed onto a brand new generation of artists?
What does the future look like?
Right. What happens when an agency applies every single lesson they learn from the friction-filled failures of BOE and the massive accidental successes of BTS and builds a group in a lab from day one?
We arrive at what the essay defines as post-K-pop.
Okay.
And this era is perfectly embodied by Big Hit's 2025 boy group, Cordis.
Right.
Big Hit, which is a subsidiary of HYBE, built Cordis from the ground up explicitly for Western crossover.
But it wasn't an afterthought.
No, it's the primary architectural design principle.
So how did they build them?
They cast a Korean-Canadian leader and a member from Hong Kong.
And this is a crucial mechanical choice.
Exactly. By casting English-speaking diaspora members, they instantly bypass the awkward translator phase on American late-night shows. They removed the friction of the language barrier in the parasocial relationship right from the start.
That's incredibly calculated.
It is. They also secured U.S. distribution through Republic Records right out of the gate.
Wow.
And they held dual country debut events, entirely circumventing the traditional slow burn of the K-pop trainee reveal cycle.
And the music itself was perfectly engineered for this frictionless transmission.
Yeah, let's look at their track Go.
This song was specifically designed to drive dance covers on social media using a style called plug.
Right.
Now, for those who don't know, plug is a subgenre of Atlanta black music.
It relies on these heavy, sparse 808 beats and spacey synths that leave a ton of sonic room.
It's essentially music designed to be watched, not just heard.
Making it the perfect vehicle for short-form TikTok choreography.
So once again, you have the K-pop machine flawlessly executing that loop.
Performing the aesthetic of black musical history, stripped entirely of its cultural origin to manufacture a viral 15-second visual moment.
Meanwhile, the rest of their album pulls from completely different focus-grouped Western influences.
Like the psychedelic pop of Tame Impala and the alternative rock of Alice in Chains.
Just a buffet of whatever's cool.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But here is the most fascinating contradiction that the essay points out.
What's that?
Despite using every tool in the K-pop arsenal, Cordis does not explicitly present itself as a K-pop group.
Wait, really?
The members describe themselves in interviews as global creators and musicians.
They don't use the word K-pop.
The label actively avoids the genre tag.
Wow.
And yet, they utilize the exact rigid architecture of the K-pop industry.
Oh, absolutely. They use the same fan platform infrastructure on Weverse to monetize text messages.
Yep.
They use the same parasocial content strategy of dropping behind-the-scenes reality shows.
Yep.
They utilize the same NBA marketing partnerships and the same algorithmic Lollapalooza festival slots.
So it literally doesn't matter if the word K-pop is completely absent from their marketing materials.
Not at all.
The machinery itself is the actual product, regardless of what genre label you slap on the packaging.
They've perfected the relationship machine to the point where it can wear any musical disguise it wants.
That is the ultimate triumph of the assembly line.
It really is. But the essay asks us to consider what happens when that highly manufactured, perfectly optimized machine comes up against genuine, friction-filled art.
Which is a great question.
To explore this, we look at a fascinating cultural contrast from the summer of 2025.
The release of the Sony and Netflix animated film K-pop Demon Hunters.
Yes.
Now, I know this sounds like a wild pivot.
It does sound random at first.
But it makes so much sense when you look at the mechanics of why music actually connects with people.
Right.
K-pop Demon Hunters is a fictional animated film about a girl group.
But what made it so resonant was that the film was brutally honest about the realities of the K-pop industry.
It didn't pull any punches.
It openly tackled the parasocial manipulation we've been talking about today.
Yeah.
It explored the intense psychological distance between the packaged, smiling persona and the real, exhausted human beings behind it.
It laid bare the entire machinery of the devotion economy.
And the commercial success of the music from that fictional film was staggering.
Let's look at the chart data from that summer.
It's crazy. The soundtrack had four different songs in the Billboard Top 10 simultaneously.
Four songs.
The standout track, Golden, which was recorded by a powerhouse team including EJ, Mark Sonnenblick, IDO, and Teddy Park, hit number one on the Hot 100.
And it stayed there for 8 consecutive weeks.
In early 2026, that specific song won both a Grammy and an Oscar.
Think about the massive irony of that timeline.
Right.
Because back in 2011, there was that Korean drama we mentioned, Dream High. That show featured a highly aspirational, fictional storyline about a Korean artist winning a Grammy in the futuristic year of 2018.
It was this massive, almost impossible dream for the entire Korean industry.
But in reality, it took until 2026, and the first K-pop song to ever win a Grammy was from a fictional animated movie.
And ironically, the Korean music industry furiously debated whether Golden even counted as K-pop at all.
Just because it wasn't produced by one of the major domestic agencies.
Exactly. If we connect this to the bigger picture, the reason Golden and the other songs from that film succeeded so massively while manufactured crossover attempts often stall is a matter of origin.
Right.
Those songs were written from real experience to serve a narrative story.
They had a specific point of view.
They were not assembled on a corporate checklist to target a generalized global demographic.
Which is such a key difference.
For example, the song Your Idol from the film acts as a direct highly uncomfortable critique of parasocial celebrity culture.
It addresses the toxic entitlement of the fan
and the trapped reality of the performer.
Yeah.
The emotion in that song is so resonant that real-life K-pop idols started singing it on their own world tours.
Wait, really?
Yes. They were essentially using a fictional song to critique the very real system they are trapped inside.
And Nisi's essay points out a brilliant head-to-head test that mechanically proves why genuine art wins.
The Too Fast cover.
Yes. The real-life, wildly popular K-pop group Twice recorded a cover of one of the film's songs titled Takedown.
And Twice has a massive, mobilized global fan base.
Massive. And yet Twice's cover only hit number 58 on the Hot 100.
While the original versions of the song sung by the fictional characters dominated the top 10 for months.
The genuine art, serving a real emotional story, utterly beat the manufactured pop machine.
It proves that you cannot fake the emotional resonance of a song written for a specific, truthful purpose.
The merchants of Cool Machine can replicate the sound perfectly.
It can hire the same producers and use the same 808s.
But it cannot manufacture the soul of the art.
Which brings us to the ultimate limitation of this entire industrialized model.
The ceiling.
There is a psychological ceiling to scaling parasocial relationships.
Let's look at exactly what that ceiling is. We can use BTS's rollout for their Project Arang.
Okay.
They executed everything the American crossover playbook demands to the letter.
Perfectly.
They released a highly polished, English-friendly lead single called Swim. They went on The Tonight Show.
Right.
They did the season finale of the massively popular YouTube show Hot Ones.
They even had their songs edited into Major League Baseball highlight reels,
which generated tens of millions of views on social media.
But despite executing the playbook flawlessly, there is documented footage showing the artists themselves feeling noticeably uncomfortable.
And disconnected, executing this highly scripted, frictionless rollout.
And the mechanical flaw in that loop is exactly what we've been circling this entire time.
What's the flaw?
The psychological ceiling of the parasocial model is that you simply cannot onboard a stranger into a deeply intimate relationship that they were never a part of. The BTS army will absolutely watch that Hot Ones episode, and they will drive the view count into the stratosphere.
Right, because they have 15 years of deep emotional investment in those specific people.
They've watched them grow up from teenagers in a cramped dorm to global superstars.
But to a casual American viewer flipping channels,
they just see a guy eating spicy chicken.
The casual viewer sees the finish line, but they never ran the race.
Exactly. They don't have the context to care.
But I have to push back here for a second, though.
Okay, what about
if the K-pop machine is hitting a ceiling because it can't onboard strangers? What about Bad Bunny?
That's a great comparison.
Right. He crossed over globally in a massive way. He sells out stadiums in countries where people don't even speak his language.
True.
He didn't have 15 years of dorm room live streams to build a parasocial army. Why couldn't K-pop just do what he did?
That is a crucial mechanical distinction. Bad Bunny crossed over globally precisely because he refused to remove his friction.
What do you mean?
He didn't try to sound American. He didn't start singing in English.
Right.
He didn't smooth out his Puerto Rican identity, his regional slang, or his specific political stances to appeal to a focus-grouped global market.
He forced the global audience to come to his world.
His extreme cultural specificity created genuine curiosity, which is exactly what drew the massive audience in.
People were attracted to how authentic and rooted he was in his own soil.
Right. Well, the K-pop crossover strategy does the exact opposite.
It deliberately strips away all of its specificity.
Yes. It hides its regional identity to optimize for a generalized global audience that their parasocial model actually already completely owns.
Exactly. When the K-pop machine pays for an MLB crossover edit, it isn't creating new baseball fans. And it isn't creating new K-pop fans.
The MLB is just renting the army's attention for a single night to boost their own metrics.
The engagement numbers look massive on paper.
But the actual cultural footprint is shallow.
Because it's built on a closed loop of existing monetized devotion, not a widening circle of genuine musical discovery.
The machine is just selling the same product to the same people over and over again in different packaging.
So what does this all mean for you, the listener?
That's the big question.
We have looked at how this incredible K-pop machine successfully generates billions of dollars.
It completely sells out stadiums on multiple continents.
And how it literally sustains entire national economies through the unshakable devotion of its fans.
It's taken the merchants of Cool Loop.
identifying authenticity, stripping it of its friction, and selling a shiny simulacrum back to the masses.
And perfected it into a highly lucrative science of human attachment.
It forces us to ask a very uncomfortable question about the nature of modern entertainment.
When you engage with modern pop culture, what is it that you are actually consuming?
Are you being moved by a piece of art?
Or are you buying into a carefully architected simulation of intimacy designed to extract your money and your loyalty?
You really have to wonder if crossing over musically is actually the goal of this industry anymore.
Or if crossover is just a convenient, prestigious story the industry tells itself while it quietly cashes the massive checks generated by the photocard economy.
You have to sit and think about what is actually happening when the art becomes a secondary feature of the business model.
And if the real product was always the relationship, never the music, if the music was always packaging for something else, then what exactly is being sold, to whom, and at what cost to the music itself?